You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Perhaps one of the reasons I responded so viscerally to Alice McDermott's beautiful new novel, Someone, is that we're both one generation removed from Brooklyn, that fabled pre-war era that, as McDermott terms it, is, or was, something of an enchanted isle. A fiction, really, she writes. Writing the novel Someone was one way she had of visiting a place that she suspected never really existed. Alice McDermott is the author of seven novels, including A Bigamist's Daughter, That Night, and At Weddings and Wakes, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Her 1998 novel, Charming Billy, won the National Book Award for Fiction. She's the recipient of many awards, including the 2008 Corrington Award for Literature, and currently is the Richard A. Maxey Professor for Distinguished Teaching in the Humanities at Johns Hopkins University. Alice McDermott's novels stay in your mind. They're so delicious and all-enveloping that you hate for them to end. Reviewer Leah Cohen wrote in the New York Times, "Such is the crisp purposefulness of McDermott's prose. Her sentences know themselves so beautifully. What each has to deliver and how best to do it within a modicum of space with minimal fuss." In an interview conducted while she was working on Someone, McDermott observed that, quote, "Novels about unremarkable women, especially those written by unremarkable women, seem a thing of the past, but that's what the novel wanted to be. It's the contrarian in me, I'm afraid." Well, one can hardly think of Alice McDermott as an unremarkable woman, but a contrarian, perhaps. Alice will talk about the universe of her new novel's protagonist, a woman both remarkable and unremarkable, as well as her great pleasure in not writing for the movies, and more with poet and playwright Bridget Mullins. Bridget Mullins' plays include The Bourgeois Pig, Monkey in the Middle, Fire Eater, and many others. In the fall of 2012, she was writer-in-residence at Deep Springs College, a working ranch in the Nevada desert where she breathed the fresh sage-scented air and talked literature with cowboys. At the end of this month, her new play, The Evidence of Things Seen, will have a workshop production at the Hartford Stage, and she teaches in and directs the Masters of Professional Writing program at USC. Please join me in welcoming Alice McDermott and Bridget Mullins. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise, and thank you all for being here. This is such a treat. This is a conversation I'm not going to take over. This is not a coup. I'm not a Republican. I'm just going to read briefly the opening pages of Someone, and then I'm going to join Bridget for our conversation. And because they're the opening pages, I don't have to explain anything. Pegeen Shahab walked up from the subway in the evening light. Her good spring coat was powder blue. Her shoes were black and covered the insteps of her long feet. Her hat was beige with something dark along the crown, a brown feather or two. There was a certain asymmetry to her shoulders. She had a loping, hunchback walk. She had always a bit of black hair along her cheek, straggling to her shoulder, her bun coming undone. She carried her purse in the lightest clasp of her fingers down along the side of her leg, which made her seem listless and weary, even as she covered the distance quickly enough, the gray sidewalk from subway to parlor floor and basement of the house next door. I was on the stoop of my own house, waiting for my father. Pegeen paused to say hello. She was not a pretty girl, particularly. There was a narrowness to her eyes and a wideness to her jaw, crooked teeth, wild eyebrows, and a faint mustache. She had her Syrian father's thick, dark hair, but also the permanent scattered flush just under the fair skin of her Irish mother's broad cheeks. She had a job in Lower Manhattan in this, her first year out of manual training, and she said she didn't like the people there. She didn't like a single one of them. She ran a bare hand along the stone balustrade above my head. The other, which lightly held the strap of her purse, wore a dove gray glove. She had lost its partner somewhere, she said, and laughed with her crooked teeth. Fourth pair this month, she said, and left the library book she was reading on the subway yesterday, and look, tore her stocking on something. She lifted her black shoe to the step where I sat and pulled back the long coat and the skirt. I saw the laddered run, the flesh of Peggy's thin and dark-haired calf pressing through between each rung. The nail of the finger Peggy ran over its length was bitten down to nothing, but the movement of her hand along the tear was gentle and conciliatory, a kind of sympathy for her own flesh, which I imitated, brushing my own hand along the unbroken silk of Peggy's stocking and then over the torn threads of the run. I'm a Don, Peggy said. That's me. That's what I am. She pulled the leg away. The skirt and the blue coat fell into place again. Across the back hem and up the left side of Peggy's good spring coat, there was a long smudge of soot that I impulsively reached out to brush away. You've got some dirt, I said. Peggy turned, twisted her chin around, arm and elbow raised, trying to see what she couldn't see because it was behind her. Where? She said. Here. I batted at the dirt until Peggy threw back her head in elaborate frustration, pulling the coat forward, winding it around her like a cloak. I'll be happy, she said, slapping at her hip, to stop going to that filthy place, meaning Lower Manhattan, where she worked. She paused, put her nose to the air in mock confidence. I'll get a boyfriend, she said. She batted her eyelashes and drew out a sly smile. They were great kidders, the Shahabs, and no boyfriends, it seemed, had yet called for Peggy. I'll get myself married, she said, and then licked all at once the four tall fingers of the gloveless hand and swatted them against the dirty cloth. Amadon, she said again, which, she explained, was her mother's word for fool. And then she released the skirt of her long coat and, dipping her shoulders, shook herself back into it again. She reminded me of a bird taking a sand bath. I fell down, she announced. She said it in the same fond and impatient tone she had used to describe the lost glove, the forgotten library book, on the subway. It was the tone a mother might use speaking about a favorite, unruly child. Peggy blew some exasperated air through her pooched-out lower lip. I don't know what the blazes makes me fall, she said impatiently. I do it all the time. She suddenly squinted, and the flush just under her downy skin rose to a deep maroon. She lowered her face to mine. Don't you dare tell my mother, she said. I was 7 years old. I spoke mostly to my parents, to my brother, to my teachers when I had to. I gave some whispered response to Father Quinn or to Mr. Lee at the candy store when my mother poked me in the ribs. I could not imagine having a conversation with Mrs. Shahab, who was red-haired and very tall. Still, I promised I would say nothing. Peggy shook herself again, standing back and lifting her shoulders inside the pale blue coat. But there's always someone nice, she said, her voice suddenly gone sing-song. Someone always helps me up. She struck another pose, coy and haughty as before, her chin in the air. She touched the feather in her hat. Today, a very handsome man gave me his hand. He asked if I was all right. A real Prince Charming. She smiled again and looked around. Just a few doors down, the older boys were playing stickball in the street. There was a knot of younger ones on the curb watching. Bill Corrigan was in his chair on the sidewalk just behind them. Peggy leaned forward once more. Tomorrow, she said breathlessly, whispering now, I'm going to look for him again. If I see him, I'm going to get real close. She leaned down, her hand on the banister above my head. I'm going to pretend to fall, see, right next to him. And he'll catch me and say, "Is it you again?" All human eyes are beautiful, but Peggy's were very black and heavily lashed and gorgeous now with the sparkle of her joke or her plan or perhaps her vision of some impossible future.
Thank you for reading that. What a gorgeous opening.
Thank you.
An introduction to this world of Brooklyn in a certain time and in a certain place. And we come back to Brooklyn, and she ends up being one of the survivors of this scene.
Unlike Peggy.
Unlike Peggy. And there's that premonition that Peggy even has for herself, "Don't tell my mother."
Yes.
Which is so wonderful. Is that childhood premonition that she has, is that something, is that based on an experience that you had? Because it just seems so authentic.
Oh, gosh. No, Peggy sort of just came up from the subway in the evening light. And I had to write about her. I have to tell you a funny story. We were talking about it at dinner. I was reading on this endless book tour in Brooklyn, and after the reading, a woman came up to me and said, "My mother is Irish and my father is Lebanese, and I have never found a character in fiction who had that background." And I opened your book, and there she was, and I was so excited, and I don't want to give anything away, but Peggy doesn't make it through the second chapter. And then you killed her.
But she does sort of haunt the book.
She does haunt the book, and I did promise this woman that I would write a prequel about Peggy's first 17 years.
And that word that she introduces Marie to, Amadon.
Yes.
Which is, I think, the only word of Irish in the book. And that is such a strong word. And even though later in the book you find out that Marie, who's telling us the story, isn't a bookworm, she loves language and she's mm-hmm. very agile with her thoughts. I mean, as Louise was saying, she seemed pretty remarkable to me, even though, you know, there is this quotidian factor where she's living her life and she's having these extraordinary interior linguistic experiences where she notices things.
Well, I think we all do. You know, I think we all think that, and we believe, and probably rightly so, that our interior voices are unique. And it's what makes someone, if it's like, "Gee, if only I could write, because I've got all these great ideas in my head." But it's that, and that was really, in many ways, the reason for being for this novel, to try to get at that active interior and complex interior life of a character who nobody really asks what she's thinking mm-hmm. throughout her whole life. A character who is not much heard from in her own life, but yet, you know, has this incredible, as we all do, interior existence.
And this storytelling capacity, I love how she talks to her daughters later in the story and tells them cautionary tales about William Hartnett, which
yes,
is hilarious.
Yes, right.
But she does seem to have, in an earlier novel, which I said to you before, I thought was my favorite Alice McDermott novel until I read this one. Now they're tied. But Child of My Heart, the main character, Teresa, is so steeped in books and in literature, and she can throw Shakespeare quotations back to this artist who she's has an affair with or a fling with, something. But there's a matching of wits there, and you feel like with Marie, she has a different set of references, but it's almost mysterious. I mean, I know there is like the ordinary beauty of the poetry of the human mind, but there's also, she, is it do you think it has something to do with the religion, or is it Brooklyn in that day and age, or?
Yeah, well, I think she's a character. She is an observing character. She wears thick glasses as a child. Yeah. She's myopic, but on the other hand, she sees things that some miss, and she misses some things that everybody else sees. But she's very much about her experience. So even that opening scene where she's given the word Amadon by Peggy'n, and she wields it very soon thereafter. And without that experience, it's not a word she would have found. So things happen to her, she's brought through her life, but then it's what she makes of those things. She's very much in her world, which may undercut the religious aspect. She's not thinking too much about other worlds. She's very much in her world.
Yeah, and as I fumble with my two pairs of glasses here, it does seem like this vision thing is a very Irish genetic sort of thing, but it's also metaphorically so incredibly rich that she's myopic, that you can describe these different ways that she sees reality.
Yes, well, I mean, in some ways, the conclusion of that opening scene is she's given this word by Peggy'n, and Peggy'n does have a fatal fall the next morning. Her parents, she goes with her parents to the parlor floor and basement apartment where Peggy'n lives for the wake, and then they all come back. This is an unusual, I suppose, Irish-American family, that there's just two kids. There's her, Gabe, Marie's older brother, and Marie herself. And Gabe is the golden child. He's good-looking. He's the firstborn. He's a boy. He's good-looking. He's a scholar. He recites poetry for his parents. He's won the elocution medal at school. And he's on his way to the seminary. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that for Irish immigrant parents in this new world. And so Gabe, in his effort to offer comfort, opens his Bible and he reads to his parents from Matthew, "Are not two sparrows sold for a small coin, and yet not one of them falls without your Father's notice? Mm-hmm. Even all the hairs of your head are counted. Do not be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows." And little 7-year-old Marie, mostly because she's so impatient with all the adulation that her brother gets and she's not paid much attention to, says into her teacup, of course they're sitting around having tea, "Amadon." She's been given the word, and for me, that those two things, the outrageousness of that proposition, "Even all the hairs on your head are counted, you are worth more than many sparrows." It's an outrageous proposition. Mm-hmm. Who could believe that? Who, you know, just look around the world. All the deaths in all the across humankind, and every single one of them matters. That's and yet Gabe believes it and wants to give this to his parents, and Marie inadvertently undercuts it. Fool. And for me, that was the tension that spurred the rest of the story. How over the arc of an entire lifetime, because we do follow Marie really to the end of her life, how does that play out? Who's the fool? Which of them? And how, through experience of life and death, can you support that outrageous proposition, or should you just dismiss it? And that became really the tension for the novel.
And I love that it's Amadon that she that she relishes the word. You know, it's the word, the incarnation of the word in and of itself is what gets summoned up at that moment.
Exactly.
And, you know, the brother doesn't understand it, but the mother yanks her in and washes her mouth out with soap, and she she has that experience of the power of language, too.
Yes, exactly. And she, while she's spitting the soapy water into the sink, she hears her brother who she refers to as the scholar, ask their father, what does it mean? And the father says, it means someone's a fool.
And I don't think I'm giving too much of... It would be hard... Flannery O'Connor says something about how literature is unparaphrasable. And so the pleasure of the book is, of course, like reading the phenomenal language, but also meeting this character, Marie, and her brother, and his vocation, hearing about his vocation. I don't think it's something that we read about much, is the pull towards this vocation in the church, and then the loss of it, but not the loss of faith. Mm-hmm. And I think that's such an interesting phenomena to look at, and how he still leads his life, but something snapped. And he doesn't talk about it, but it's the subtext.
Yes, yeah. And again, that was one of the things I was interested in. Not just this ethnic milieu, but also an era in which there was so much that was not spoken of, mm-hmm. So much that would not have been discussed. Yeah. And I was really aware, I mean, in some ways, the older I get, the more I realize I'm inadvertently writing historical fiction, whether I want to or not. You know, it's like, wow, that happened? You know, that was a long time ago. But in some ways, this is historical fiction. It's not my own experience. But I was very aware in trying to capture the interior life of a woman living across these decades, not to apply a kind of presentism to the mm-hmm. way she would look at the world, or even mm-hmm. the way around the people around her would see the world. So, you know, in 2013, when you say, young, good-looking guy went into the seminary at 17, and then as soon as he became a priest, he came out, we all go, oh, he's gay, you know. Mm-hmm. But that was not the way any of them looked at it. Mm-hmm. So when he said it was a mystery and they all have their theories, but it was not discussed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there is that, what seems to me, a very authentic Irish inability to articulate sexual nature.
Yes.
That's also going on with, and it's just sort of dropped into the novel as a sort of urban legend of the woman marrying the other woman. And like the kind of shockwaves that runs through the family. But I wanted to read you something, actually, that you said once.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Fasten your seatbelt, people. Okay. This is, I think it was from Charming Billy, the writing of Charming Billy. And I just found it so fascinating in terms of the structure of this book, which the time, the sequence, it moves associatively. Mm-hmm. And yet there is this arc of a story, and you have this life, and you come away feeling like you have met this incredible soul, you know, and she sort of illuminates other women that you might know, like my Aunt Mary, who just...
They're all named Mary.
And they're all from Long Island. They all live on Long Island. But you said an important element of the novel would involve my narrator's need to put the story together. That is how stories come to us. Human beings do not sit down and suddenly tell a story from beginning to end. Early on in the writing of Charming Billy, it became clear to me that in many ways the story would really be about the way the narrator was gathering pieces of the story at various times, and at the same time adding her own prejudices and imaginings. And I felt like this similarly had a kind of someone figuring out their mm-hmm. life in the present tense, mm-hmm. even as they were in the past.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, probably what someone doesn't have, the novel itself doesn't have the self-awareness, and that is, this is a first-person narrative, but not not a Gilead, for instance, of a narrator saying, I'm writing this for you, mm-hmm. or even in Charming Billy, addressing someone from outside the community and trying to explain it. This, I see this as much more, again, an interior, maybe as you put it, the portrait of a soul, but not a self-conscious accounting, this is what my life mm-hmm. was like. Because I think as soon as the self-consciousness came in, then untruth would come in and exaggeration. And so I guess I wanted the story to be, to sort of hone even closer to, again, to her interior life. She tells us later, I would tell this story about her first love friends to my daughters, you know, to warn them against guys who don't look you in the eye when they're talking to you, but look over your shoulder to see who else is coming in. Stay away from those guys. You know, she tells us, or she speaks that into the dark, paraphrasing John Cheever, but there's not a self-consciousness on her part of, I'm trying to figure out my life.
Mm-hmm. And then my brother-in-law, Paul Contino, pointed this out to me, that there was it came back to me with sort of alienated majesty after I had read the book, is that I had read a version of the story called Someone, which is that, you know, it's wonderful section of the book that does seem to stand alone, mm-hmm. but it's written in third person. And I went through, I actually felt like I was doing a Janet Fitch exercise as I was doing this, but I went through and I looked at third person versus first person and why you had made that switch. Mm. And even, it's utterly gorgeous in third person, but in first person, it comes off the page and you're really with her. And I wondered if you could talk about that decision to go from third to first.
Yes, yeah. The excerpt that appeared in The New Yorker, something I have never done before, and I don't know if I'll ever do it again, and that is to show a piece of work that's not finished. My editor doesn't even see the book until I'm pretty much finished with it. But my agent is trying to feed her three children, and she wanted me to, and she felt sure that there must be an excerpt somewhere in there. And I was taking a little long getting this book finished. 7 years since my last book is longer than I usually take. And as my editor said to me at first, oh, it's so nice. I like the symmetry. Seventh novel, it's been 7 years. It's kind of nice, but don't ever do that again. But anyway, So The New Yorker was interested, and when The New Yorker calls, most of us say, okay. But at the time, everything I had written was in the third person, and I had pretty much finished the novel and had a nagging sense that it wasn't right, that voice wasn't right. And what I realized was, you know, going back to my initial intentions, to give voice to a woman who didn't have much voice in her own life, who lived through an era where women in general didn't have much voice, you know, who wore thick glasses in an era when people said men don't make passes at girls who wear glasses, and they didn't say it ironically or comically, they meant it, and whose options were you get married and start having lots of children, or you'll be an old maid, or you can go into the convent to avoid that. So trying to understand and give voice to this character who had no voice, I realized, and then here I came along as the writer, and I took away her voice. And it was still the same story, and much of the same, almost everything stayed. But I had intervened somehow simply by telling her story in third person, and I had to give it back to her.
Mm-hmm. And I know I had asked you about that one paragraph about dreaming, because I thought, oh, I've made a find. There is this one paragraph that's in the novel that's not in the short story. You know, I felt like the literary scholar I am not. But then you told me that actually that paragraph, which maybe you would read. I mean, it really is a remarkable paragraph. Sure. If I can find it. There's the you told me that the real reason was that what was the real reason?
They needed to fit it into the magazine.
Yeah. And it's, I thought it fit in with the whole idea of dreaming and visions that go throughout, because you describe insomnia so well. And that this was the passage that described how she couldn't sleep. And it's on in my book. Let's see.
Is it this one? This is...
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is just after Marie has had her first semi-sexual encounter with Walter Hartnett, a boy from the neighborhood who, out of the blue, seems to notice her and takes her out for a soda and then brings her back to his mother's apartment because he thought maybe his mother would like to say hello to her. Mother just saw her at Mass that Sunday, and then, of course, Mom's not there.
And I love what he says to her. So he walks her back home, and he says to her, go in, he said, touching my hip. Go tell your mother you've got a boyfriend. Dear, what an
Walter's
ego.
Yeah, Walter's kind of fond of himself.
Yes.
So right after, Walter tells her, go tell your mother you've got a boyfriend. There's a space break. And this is the paragraph that the New Yorker couldn't fit in. All the thought and all the worry, all the faith and the philosophy, the paintings and the stories and the poems, all the whatnot, gone into the study of heaven or hell, and yet so little wonder applied to the sinking into sleep, falling asleep. All the prayers I had said before bed throughout my life, all the prayers I had made my children say, Our Father, Hail Mary, glory be, the confiteor if some transgression had taken place, missed the mark entirely. It was grace, the simple prayer before meals that we should have been murmuring into our clasped hands at the end of the day. Bless us, O Lord, and this thy gift, which we are about to receive. Now that I come to this, it's probably too Catholic for the New Yorker. That's probably the real reason. That had nothing to do with word count.
Yeah.
We can't say Hail Mary. This is the New Yorker.
And you have, throughout your work, you have these sections. I also love An After This, which is your only novel that was made into a film, and I know we will talk about the title in a moment. But the section from After This with Monsignor McShane. Do you remember that? Well, I have the paragraph here, but it reminded me. And I did want to talk a little bit about faith and your faith and the telling of stories, because I feel like reading through your work and thinking about the Catholic writer in America, thinking about Ann Carson, thinking about Flannery O'Connor, thinking about what that is to write into that. Mm-hmm. So this is just an amazing Monsignor McShane.
So now we're going back to stuff I don't even remember.
Did you write that?
No.
What?
Do you mean this?
No, not that. What you see.
It's beautiful piece of criticism, but
oh, this is Paul Contino.
Paul.
Oh, okay. Well, Paul writes an awful lot about your, well, not an awful lot, but he writes about your relationship to faith and to your Catholicism,
right,
and this is Paul describing,
right?
And okay, and about a character who lies beside a young woman whom he has just met and recalls a hot childhood prayer. Hail, Holy Queen, Mother of Mercy, our life, our sweetness, and our hope. And anyone who is raised Catholic loves that. Our life, our sweetness, and our hope.
There
we. And was that like a first falling into language for you?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
I think I think that's sort of in my my language DNA. The language of the church, the repetition, the sense of prayer. Also in words given to you that because we don't have words for these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that's what led me to read poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Someone will give you words for what life has taken the words away from you. And so certainly the rhythms of the ritual, the repetitions, but also the very notion that we need someone to give us words for what we can't describe ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to have them handy.
That's why I brought Yeats.
Yes.
Now, I know you love Yeats. And I was just thinking, I don't know if you'd want to read a Yeats for us, a Yeats poem.
Or you could.
Oh, no. Is there, I know there's one that you...
Well, actually, I was just saying, I'm carrying around with me, Yeats has a very small collection called Celtic Twilight, mm-hmm. about his experiences in Ireland. And really, he was trying to collect the stories of the fairies. And actually, there's Amadon is mentioned in that, too. Someone pointed out to me. In reading this, I found a line of Yeats's that, poor Yeats, you know, he's everybody borrows him for titles. I think most of his poems have been given over to titles. You know, he's like the rag and bone shop of people looking for literary titles.
Really, so you could open it at random.
Yes, you exactly, really right. So you always feel everybody's laid their eyes on everything he's ever written. But in Celtic Twilight, he writes this thing, and I'm still thinking about it, and he said, hope and memory have but one daughter, and her name is Art. Hmm. And I'm just, you know, hope and memory. Just for him to put those two things together, and then that's the definition of art. Just it enchants me, mm-hmm. in many ways. So there's a little line from Yeats.
Yes, yes,
from
yes.
his prose.
And some Irish. American and Irish writers feel this burden of the Irish, the huge Irish pantheon, which, you know, made Beckett leave. And, yeah. you know, others just sort of like divert for a while. Is there any of that for you with your reading or as you were
reading
growing up?
I don't feel any burden of it. And again, I know, I think it's, you know, there's a kind of gift to it. I mean, there's the gift of language. And again, I don't think it can be separated from my experience as a Catholic. That language is very much a part of the Irish, mm-hmm. way of dealing with language. And that sense of worlds we can't see, mm-hmm. And the underneath. Another thing that Yeats mentions in Celtic Twilight, he makes a distinction about how the folk tales in Scotland turn the fairies and the banshees into evil things, scary things. But the Irish are pretty comfortable with their ghosts and their fairies. They can get along. They said, and he said, and even the church, you know. Has to acknowledge that they're good, you know, they're not bad things, and they're not, of course, that they can't be immortal, that would undercut things, but we needn't be afraid of them. And Yeats writes, because the Catholic Church always likes to be friendly with its neighbors. and that whole sense of, you know, something beyond what we see, something that comes to us unbidden often, fairy music, mm-hmm. Seamus Heaney wrote about that a lot too, that gifts from someplace we can't quite define, or if we do define, we'll probably be wrong about, and yet things that shore us up and delight us, mm-hmm. And let us see beyond this mortal realm, and encourage us that death is not the end. Mm-hmm. And all that, I mean, you can see how all those ideas fit so beautifully. And in some ways, in someone having those the tension between Gabe, who's headed for the priesthood, reciting from Matthew, and Marie, whose father, after Marie calls her brother an Amadon, from then on, the father refers to her as our little pagan. we've got a bishop, and we've got our little pagan. But that kind of that the two things, the paganism, you mm-hmm. know, and the belief in from experience of strange things in the world, mm-hmm. and then the way the Catholic Church defines strange things in the world, can in some ways, you know, be harmonious. Mm-hmm. They're not contradicting each other. Mm-hmm. In some ways, they're arising from the same source.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's how Marie is able to live her life, it seems, that she's able to see these, you know, the dead laid out at Fagin's funeral home and to still take joy in things. And she doesn't ever seem to give up. I mean, she's just, even when the doctor operates on the wrong eye, Yes, like, yeah. I mean, that was so Irish to me. It was like, yeah, got the wrong eye. Well, that's okay. I probably deserved it. Right, that one exactly. Probably, you know,
I'm
it's
always
okay.
Confused about left and right. It was my fault.
Yeah,
it wasn't
yeah.
His fault.
I was just so Irish. But that kind of like, I was thinking of that term, the holy fool.
Yes,
like the person
yes.
who isn't the Gabe who's steeped in the knowledge of things, but just has like a natural relationship with goodness.
Right.
Although
right.
she, of course, would never say that about herself.
No, but, no, not at all. Yeah. And again, attuned to dreams,
yeah.
you know, and intuiting, even if not defining things that are somewhat otherworldly, again, over the course of her life. And that was something very important to me. Not that she would have these great moments, but over the course of a life, where are those moments when something shines through, something other than what is, and how she would, looking back and putting this together, really narrate those moments
mm-hmm.
Without giving them a specific either pagan or religious
yeah.
context,
yeah.
But. And yet they are redemptive in their own way. Yeah. I mean, that's I think, what both, brother and sister, ultimately, there's a kind of mutual redemption that they offer one another.
And it's so unexpected at the end that this is how it would be. So it seems so authentic. That the dream that she has at the end, which I won't give away because I don't know if you've read this yet, but I read that. Her dream four or five times. I couldn't believe the subtlety that, how did you write that? and how did you write this book? You didn't start with the story that appeared in the New Yorker.
No. The story began with Peggy coming up from the subway. But my intention with that, and this is, you know, this strange and wonderful thing about language, at least for me, the way I see it, I had this vague intention of, as Louise mentioned, sort of being a contrarian and giving over an entire novel to a woman's voice. I wasn't seeing a lot of that happening. And as soon as you say, God damn it, I'm going to do it, the next thing you say is, oh, I'm going to get really in trouble for doing this. This is not a good career move. But I was determined that the novel would be hers alone, and it would cover that era, sort of more or less cover the 20th century. And there was a phrase that I had heard from that generation, my mother and father's generation, the parents of all my friends who were from that area, and it was just that simple parlor floor and basement. Number one, it's lovely, antique sort of phrase. Nobody even says parlor anymore. For those of you who are familiar with what brownstones look like when, as the immigrant population was moving into New York, turn of the last century, the brownstones were being broken up into apartments, and there'd be an apartment that would be parlor floor and basement. So you go up the steps to the parlor floor, which would often have the bay windows or the high windows, and then the basement, which would be street level, would be where the kitchen is and sort of where life goes on. And the parlor was usually, you know, the nice place for Sunday visits. You go in and dust it, but nobody really hangs out in there. So it had that antique phrase, and I something about the phrase delighted me, and maybe that it was leaving. You know, our awareness, it's on its way out. Parlor floor and basement, is not going to be in the lexicon for much longer. But teasing that out, it also, I thought about how for these new immigrants, it kind of gave place to two things. One is the aspirational, parlor floor, propriety. Society, the place you want to show to the world, the face you want to show, the nice place that's not messed up by life, and then basement, and just the fact that they refer to it as basement, not even cellar would have been more refined, but basement, basic that's where the kitchen is, that's where you put the garbage out, that's where you come in and out when your shoes are muddy, that's where life is. And the idea of negotiating those two. So just by thinking about that, which means there are stairs, which means, you know, that difficulty of what we hope to be or what we hope to appear to be, and then daily life and its muddiness. And just by teasing that metaphor out, I began to see what one of the sort of controlling tensions in the novel would be, just negotiating. And then if you're negotiating the stairs, someone's going to fall down the stairs. So as soon as I wrote that Pegin Shahab, and Pegin having these two different backgrounds, both her parents are immigrants, but very different immigrants from very different places. And as soon as I had the stairs and I knew that Pegin lives in the apartment, that's the parlor floor and basement, not Marie, but Pegin does. So as soon as I wrote that she came up from the subway, I knew she was coming up to go down.
That's amazing. I mean, that's just, and also that idea of the terrain. And as you were speaking, I don't know who said this, but someone will. That the phrase or the image of the parlor that which haunts the ear and the eager parts of the mind. And that's where the writing comes from. And you know, I have to say, I was so excited when I read the first paragraph because I thought, Pegin Shahab. I've never read a character like this in Alice McDermott. Who is this strange creature? And, you know, she was meat for the mowing, basically. But great introduction to the whole world. I have a friend, a novelist, Gabrielle Pina, who's always using or often uses Zora Neale Hurston's work when she teaches her graduate students. And Hurston has this definition of research as, she says, research is formalized curiosity. And I wonder, was the research that you did more, was it, you said there's an element of historical fiction here. Mm-hmm. Was it that you researched your own memories? Did you research other people's memories? Or was it more metaphorical than that?
You know, it's probably all those things combined. Certainly, you know, I had a certain sound in my head from my own experience, the stories that I had heard, language that I'd heard used. But also it was an era, you know, that, again, I hadn't lived through. But for me, I mean, I need to do my research after I've written the novel, not before. Research, the siren song of research, because you can spend so much time looking up so many cool things and never write a word. And for me, and I guess in some ways I think this distinguishes literary fiction from other kinds of fiction, and certainly from journalism or memoir or nonfiction. And that is, I think literary fiction really writes from the inside out. So to describe a world from the outside in, that here's this world and here are the people who live in this world, is one thing. And I think that's the realm of historical fiction and nonfiction. But I think what a certain kind of fiction can do, and poetry certainly does this pretty well, is to look out. And so that whatever is seen is not so much because it's there, it's because how it defines the character. The character is the primary I, and the world around it is shaped by that I rather than opposite, which a journalist would do. So I think, you know, that so to hear the voice, to understand, you know, who is this person who's speaking, and who are the and to understand that first, and often when I get to a point, and this happens, you know, am I sure about my dates? Am I sure about you know where things would be? I'll take a best guess rather than stop and then go off and, you know, start Googling things and then the day's over and, you know, the sentence isn't down and I didn't know that. Did you know that? I'm going to put this in the novel. It's just so interesting. It has nothing to do with the novel, but I've discovered it. So I try to wait, and then when I know the characters, then I can do research and I can know what the characters would know. Yeah. But I need to know the characters first.
Like that section in the deli in Rego Park.
Yes, right?
It's just amazing. Yeah. I have you to myself for a few more minutes, so then we'll open it up to questions. So if you feel a question brewing, so now's the time to start formulating it so you can ask it. But I'm going to ask the question of this incredibly provocative title to suggest for your talk here in Los Angeles, where we are so close to what Bertolt Brecht called the bourgeois narcotics factory of Hollywood. What is the thrown gauntlet of the title of this talk?
The pleasure of not writing for the movies. Well, on a very simplistic level, and I often make this argument to my writing students, people who write screenplays can really only use two senses, what you see and what you hear. They can't make a smell anything. I mean, unless you get smell-o-vision, as they used to say, or people start pumping scents into theaters. A character can say to another character, "Oh, it smells like something's burning," you know. But we can't smell it, and we can see characters touching, but we can't feel it. Mm. And we can watch characters eating, but we can't taste it. We can assume, we can extrapolate, but we can't be inside those three senses. Mm-hmm. Fiction writers can use all five.
What about playwrights?
Nope.
But if you're watching a live actor, don't you think there's some empathy connection that's different from watching?
Oh, that's different. Yeah, I mean, I'm you know, strictly speaking, the senses. I mean, I suppose. You know, you can have stage cigarettes and the audience can smell the cigarettes. That works. I think there is a huge difference, I think, between what goes on stage. As we were talking before, there's still the sense of anything can happen. Mm-hmm. In a production of a play.
Even if you know what's supposed to happen.
Exactly.
Anything
can still happen. And there's flesh and there's time that's real. I think that distinguishes plays from screenplays in all kinds of subtle ways. But I think in the broad sense, a novelist just has so much more. And we have the interior life. My first encounter with Hollywood was after I published my first novel. I had a phone call from Scott Rudin that Milos Forman, the director, was very interested in directing a movie version of That Night. And I was living down in La Jolla at the time, and so the big limousine pulled up, and I flew. I mean, this is Hollywood. Forman was living in L.A., and Scott Rudin was living in L.A., and I was living in La Jolla, and we all met for dinner in New York to discuss. It's like, this never happens in publishing, you know. So I fly to New York and go out to dinner with Milos and Scott, and Milos, I got into the limousine when we were going down to Lower Manhattan for dinner, and Milos Forman took my hand, and this is true, and said, "Is this the hand that wrote that beautiful book?" And then he turned around. Immediately, the next thing he said was, "I have one piece of advice for you. Get all your money up front." Because movies never make profits. They never have to make up. Get all your money up front. And then we talked about, over dinner, we talked about what the screenplay would be. And he said, "Oh, you know, and you have this wonderful," it was a first-person narrator, "oh, you have this wonderful," but in movies, first-person narrator never works. Voiceover never works. Eliminate it. It's just, he said, "What you do is you show me, here's the door, here's who comes through it, and here's what he says." That's screenwriting. And that's when I realized, I can't do that, you know, because I would. There's a wonderful line from Wallace Stevens, from his great poem, Postcard from the Volcano. And it says, it starts out, children picking up our bones will never know that these were once as quick as foxes on the hill. And then it goes on to say, but with our bones, we left much more. We left what we felt at what we saw. And that's, for me, that's the realm of fiction that that makes it unique. Yeah. What we felt at what, not just what we saw, but what we felt at what we saw.
And that, so writing the novel too feels almost like an act of faith, because it's such a, it seems to me like such a leap into this other world.
Well, it is, and it also that sense of going ahead without knowing. You know, Peggy Shahab walked up from the subway in the evening light, and that's all I got, you know. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't, you know, I don't know if I can fill out 200 or 300 pages with that, with just that one domino going down. And so that sense of simply putting yourself at the service of the characters and saying eventually they will show me what their story is, and the language will bring me to understand what it is I'm trying to say. Seamus Heaney, who we just lost, says in a poem called Gravel Walks, but he also said it in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech to young poets, that we must teach ourselves to walk on air against our better judgment. And I think that's the creative, that's stepping off the end. I think that's the creative process for any artist in any of the arts. Just stepping off and leaving yourself open, and you could call it inspiration or luck, you know, or the fairies visiting you, you know, or the Holy Spirit descending, whatever metaphor you want to use. But it's, but you, I think you have to step off into the darkness in order to receive it.
Well, fortunately for you, it's that portion of the evening where we will take some questions, and there are
I really loved your novel. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the mother-daughter relationship.
In someone,
yeah.
Thank you. Yes, yeah. Yeah, well, that certainly is as important as all these other things I'm claiming that it's about. And it was important to me that it was a complex relationship, that there's tremendous love between Marie and her mother, and I think between Marie as a mother and her two daughters. But also strife, you know, and stubbornness, and difficulty. I suppose for me in the novel, there's a moment, and you won't have to read it after this. You can just
yes, you will actually
just summarize. But Marie has a very rough time in giving birth the first time. She has a C-section, and then gets an infection, and is given the last rites. It looks like she's not going to make. But at one point, she awakes in her hospital room. And she sees her mother sitting in the room with her, you know, doing what mothers do, sitting by the bedside of the ailing child, and she talks about. See, I can't even paraphrase it. So now you do have to buy the book. she talks about just the sense of being loved unconditionally. That just her mother being there after this ordeal. She's been to death's door, as she says, and then having that sense. That she is thoroughly loved just by her mother, the physical presence of her mother being there, so much so that she thinks maybe they both have died while she was going through a ordeal, because what could be better than this, just this moment of human love, simple as that. And so with that at the heart, but then also understanding these characters are human, and mothers are human, and daughters are human, and so making sure that there was a balance between the Mother's Day sentiment of that and the reality of being a daughter myself and having gone through being the mother of a 14-year-old girl.
Yeah. And the Irish soda bread section is amazing when she says
Hi.
Hi there.
Not a question, really, but your comments about working in Hollywood. There's a very famous quotation. I can't, unfortunately, remember who said it originally, but it's something to the effect that working in Hollywood is like climbing an enormous mountain of cow dung to reach the perfect rose. And by the time you climb this mountain of cow dung and reach the rose, you find you've lost the sense of smell.
I love it. Thank you.
Hi. Hi there. Loved someone.
And thank you.
Throughout, and you're wonderful with language, amazing with language. And throughout, there is an echo. Like once she talks about how the smell of alcohol on someone's breath charms her. And later she says, it charms me still, the smell of alcohol. Mm-hmm. And the vulnerability of a neck and these long feet and the instep. And they're sort of throughout. And they really provide character. But I wondered if you felt like you were taking a risk. Because you know how they say, never repeat anything, never say the same thing twice. And
right.
yet you do so deliberately.
Right, yes, yeah. Yes, certainly. I worried about that very thing. Among you know the 3,000 things you worry about at any given moment when you're doing these crazy pursuits, but in some ways it goes back to what we were saying earlier: the language of the church, the language of repetition, but also in this novel especially that sense of what resonates over time, that what experience stays with us. You know, I don't write heavily plotted novels, mostly I think because I don't trust a single moment. A single moment doesn't ever define us. And terrible and wonderful things happen to us, but then time rushes on and they change. And things that we thought we couldn't bear, 10 years later we see we're bearing, you know. Looking back at a terrible or even a wonderful moment, it changes if you're looking back 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. So in some ways what I was looking for in this book, because it covers this woman's entire life, are the things that resonate at the various times. So that as a child, because her father drank, the smell of alcohol on a man's breath was one of her first memories, and it's a lovely memory. And how that resonates throughout when she knows better, you know, when she meets up with her first boyfriend and realizes he's a pathetic alcoholic, and yet when he leans down and speaks to her, there's something of the charm still. So, and it's not so much trying to find what's true, but just finding those things that last enough to define a life over a lifetime. Fortunately, I have a very indulgent editor who isn't one of those editors who said, oh, you said this word 40 pages ago, you can't say it again.
One thing I noticed is how the word vigil gets introduced early on before she really knows what it is, and then
yes.
it like amplifies and comes back and amplifies.
Yes.
I love your book, and I
Thank
love
you.
All of your books.
Thank you.
And will we have to wait another 7 years?
Did my editor send you? I have a terrible habit, and any of you who are writing should not take this as advice. It's a terrible habit. I always work on two books at the same time. I always have two novels under development, so to speak. And sometimes one falls away. Sometimes I put it aside in order to finish one, and then I go back and I transform it. My editor sometimes refers to it as the sacrificial twin, you know, or the booster rocket, you know, the one that you wrote until you wrote the one that really took off. And at present, you know, and one mustn't say too much until it's until the fat lady sings, until it's over. But I do have a novel that has not fallen away and that's fairly well along that I'm actually looking forward to getting back to, which is probably The Kiss of Death. You know, I should probably be dreading to going back to it, because then that must mean it's good. That's that Catholic thing, you know. but I think, you know, if the stars align, it won't be 7 years. Thank you.
Oh, in the front row.
Hi. I just wanted to ask you, in listening to how you write, Do you enjoy the process of writing immensely, or do you get lost in it, or do you like having written, or is it someplace in between?
I can't say. I mean, I can't say that I love the process. I love being there, and I love working at it. But I'm miserable most of the time while I'm doing it. So, and anybody who lives with me will attest to that. I love the pursuit, and I guess in some ways I love the despair that the pursuit brings with it. I love the fear. You know, I love the sense of you shouldn't be doing this. You know, I mean, I know I have written in my notebook, literally, there are so many men in this novel that have such more interesting lives. Maybe I should give a couple of them a chapter, you know, just, you know, her husband was in a POW camp. You know, I could really prove to the big boys that I know how to write, because I could write about prisoners in a Baltic POW camp, and everybody will see, she must have done a lot of research. She's really breaking out of that Irish Catholic thing, you know. I mean, and so there's constantly the impulse. You're always looking over your shoulder, and then you're always trying to block it out. And those moments when you do block it out, and when you know you are putting yourself at the service of something that you really only barely intuit, you don't really know what the story is, you don't really know what the shape is, but you have some vague sense of it, and that if you just work hard enough and you keep at it, you will get closer to it. Maybe not ever capture it, and maybe that's why you write the next one, because you didn't capture it. Mm-hmm. But that's what drives me. So it's not loving it, and it's not so much hating it. It's the challenge of it. You know, it's wishing sometimes that you could do something else, you know, and knowing that you can't.
Wow, I can't think of a more amazing place to. Well, I would just say to the audience, as you know, there are books available in the lobby, and Alice will be signing the books. And of course, we'll thank Louise for all of her beautiful work curating this series and all the staff here at Aloud. It's such a treasure in Los Angeles to have this series. And so let's just thank this remarkable writer for coming to join us.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.